From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News. Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm your moderator, Barbara Slavin, director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. On the panel this week, a newcomer, Dan Raviv, senior Washington correspondent for I-24 News and a foreign affairs columnist for Newsday. And also Paul Brandis returns. He's White House correspondent for West Wing Reports. And here are the issues. The Trump administration's effort to repeal and replace Obamacare is in serious jeopardy. There are doubts whether Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell can muster enough Republican votes to even get a bill to the floor to debate. The Trump administration grudgingly certified for the second time that Iran is complying with a landmark nuclear deal. It followed this by announcing more sanctions directed primarily against Iran's ballistic missile program. President Trump held a second previously unannounced conversation with Russian President Vladimir Putin at a dinner at the G20 summit in Hamburg last month. The two men spoke via a Russian translator. No American note taker was present. And finally, Saudi Arabia detained but then released a young woman who had been videotaped walking down a quiet street in the capital. Unusually in that country, she was wearing only a short skirt and a crop top. Gentlemen, let's start with Obamacare and the domestic agenda. Paul, President Trump has now been in office for 6 months, and of course his first priority that he chose was to repeal and replace Obamacare. How's that going?
Well, not too well, Barbara. I mean, he spent his entire campaign saying that on day one, he wanted Congress to send him a bill repealing Obamacare. That obviously didn't happen. And now here we are 6 months later and nothing has happened. The House of Representatives, as you know, back in May passed a bill just barely. The Senate had its own version of a bill that went nowhere. There were simply too many defections within the Republican Party itself to support it. And now it looks like it's going to go nowhere. So it's, I think, a stinging, frankly, humiliating setback for the president here. One of his big signature issues, which has gone absolutely nowhere. In fact, this week marked his six-month anniversary in office. And if you look at what he has done, not one major piece of legislation in his first 6 months.
Yeah. Dan, there is a replacement bill. But it's not even clear that it's going to get a vote. McConnell is trying to simply get a procedural vote in the Senate, and for that he needs 50 votes.
Mitch McConnell, of course, the majority leader, the Republican leader
in the Senate.
And no, he can't get even his party, the Republicans, who have a small majority. There are 100 U.S. senators, 52 of them are Republicans. So if two don't like the bill, it could scrape through. But if three don't like a bill, well, the bill doesn't go anywhere. And so it's not even the same health reform bill that the House of Representatives passed. It's a different bill. And so that would be a problem even if it did pass. But I think it's a measure largely, Barbara and Paul, of President Trump's prestige. Either he can or cannot persuade his own party to pass something that's a signature bill. Americans may also worry about the bill itself, whether it takes away some subsidies that would help people buy the health insurance that they need. And really the big change, by the way, is if any of these Republican bills pass, no longer will it be mandatory under U.S. law to buy health insurance. That's something that President Obama brought in as part of Obamacare 7 years ago. Some Americans think that's fine, and they understand that that's the only way that there'll be enough money in the insurance system if everyone has to buy. But Republicans say that's terrible. You cannot compel people to buy something they don't want. One other thing, John McCain, the Republican senator, it was revealed this week, his office revealed that he's fighting brain cancer. Now, if he's not in Washington, he says he'll come back soon and maybe even while getting treatment. But if he's not here, well, that's one more Republican vote they don't have.
Yeah. Paul, one more thing about the legislation that they had been considering would have limitations on Medicaid, which is a program that pays for elderly in nursing homes, for poor people, for women and children. And there was an estimate that came out from the Congressional Budget Office that said that 22 million more people would be uninsured in a decade if this particular provision passed. And I think one thing that's been interesting is that Obamacare was unpopular in the country before the Republicans took over, and now it's suddenly become popular.
Well, the problem here is that people don't get elected to office by promising to take things away from people, and you don't stay in office by trying to do that either. Now, Obamacare certainly has its flaws. Even the Democrats admit that. But look, at the same time, it has expanded coverage to millions of Americans, including a lot of people in these so-called red states, Republican states. And in some respects, this whole issue over health care is, yes, it's about health care, but it's also about federal spending. Medicaid, for example, spending is growing much faster than the economy, much faster than tax revenues. In other words, we can't afford the way we've been going to keep up with Medicaid. So in a way, that is really what the Republicans are looking at. So what the bill, what the Republicans have proposed is over the next 10 years or so, about $750 billion in Medicaid cuts. So it's politically unpopular for Republicans to support something that is going to hurt people. That's not what politicians do.
One last question on this, Dan, and that is, if this does not go through, what does that do to the rest of the Trump agenda? What does it do for tax cuts? I mean, there's some things that Congress has to do. It has to pass a budget, has to pass an increase in the debt ceiling. These things have to be done.
So several congressional staffers, Barbara, told me that no one on Capitol Hill, no one in Congress is afraid of President Trump, largely because of what's happened with the health reform bills. They feel, even Republican staffers, people who are in his party, that the president didn't go to the trouble of learning the details of health reform, and so they wonder, will he be any better when he pushes changes to the tax system, including tax cuts? Will he be any better with the annual budget that you mentioned? In general, the Republicans, especially on Capitol Hill, think he's been strong on foreign affairs. He's changed the tone in our country in his 6 months as president, in being now pro-business, frankly, pro-police. It's also true, they admit, anti-immigrant in general. There really are changes in the 6 months, but not accomplishments in Congress.
Okay. I want to move on to an issue that I follow very closely since I run a program on it at the Atlantic Council, and that's this business of policy toward Iran, Paul. Every 90 days, the administration has to recertify that Iran is complying with the nuclear deal that was reached a couple of years ago. This is the way this has been set up because what the United States promised under the deal was that it would waive certain sanctions. But it's a periodic thing, has to happen every 3 months. And it happened again in the last few days, but President Trump reportedly was very unhappy about having to make this certification. What is your sense of the state of play, the state of the relationship between the United States and Iran now?
Well, this is another one of the big issues that then candidate Trump talked about when he was running for office. He said the Iran deal was terrible. He was going to rip it up. He's had two opportunities now, as you say, to decertify it. The broader issue for him is that I think he now understands, I'm not sure he understood before, that the Iran nuclear deal is not a U.S.-Iran deal. It's an Iran, U.S., Britain, France, Germany, Russia, China deal.
U.N. Security Council,
yes,
meaning international law deal.
Which makes it much more complicated. And I honestly am not sure that Trump understood that until he came to the White House. Now, Defense Secretary Mattis, Secretary of State Tillerson, convinced him to go along with it, but very reluctantly that he did.
Yeah, Dan, I know you know a lot about this subject as well and have followed it very closely. President Trump has not shown any shyness about walking away from international agreements. I mean, he walked out of the Paris Climate Accords. He walked out of a trade pact with 11 Pacific Rim nations.
Right.
He wants to do everything bilaterally and make deals. He doesn't like multilateral institutions, it seems, very much. So why do you think in the end he is sticking by this Iran deal?
I guess he listened to his aides this time. So that was in mid-April and then again in mid-July. Let's look at the calendar. Next time would be the middle of October. Unless he hears something that really persuades him that the Iran nuclear deal can be good, he's going to want to, well, he said tear it up during the campaign. It's not easy to tear up. It's multilateral, as you say.
He's also talked about renegotiating it, but that's kind of a non-starter.
Well, you know better than I that the parties are not going to sit down again and do that, and how Iran would react. In effect, I'll turn it around and ask you in just a second, because I just want to point out that what the President of the United States is asked to do by Congress is to certify that Iran is respecting the agreement, that Iran really has taken away a lot of the centrifuges that were enriching uranium and taken other steps as well, getting rid of nuclear fuel, et cetera, making it very unlikely that Iran is developing a nuclear bomb at this time. Now, people close to President Trump say, yeah, at this time, but this deal almost guarantees that in about a decade, if Iran wants to develop nuclear weapons, they'll do it, and very quickly. I-24 News, where I'm based, by the way, where I work in Washington, is an Israeli channel, though I'm the Washington guy, I'm an American, but I know that Israelis in general also think that Iran in about a decade will want to develop a nuclear bomb, but for now, Iran is stopped. But Trump doesn't like the deal. And don't forget, this past week, on the very day that he certified that Iran is abiding by the agreement, he also imposed new sanctions on 18 individuals and entities, Iranians who allegedly are involved with missile work and with helping terrorist funding. And so he wants to take a hard line on Iran. Now, how would Iran react if Trump decertified the deal and pulled the U.S. out?
Yeah. Well, you know, I had some time a few days ago with the Iranian foreign minister, Javad Zarif, who came to New York, I think for a bunch of reasons. I think, first of all, to do some public relations and argue Iran's case, and also to do some fact-finding and get a sense of where the United States is going by talking to a number of people, including members of Congress as well as journalists and think tankers. I think the Iranians are playing it very cool for the time being, because they are getting some benefits from the agreement. They are getting more businesses returning. Total, the big French oil company, recently signed a major deal with them. In terms of regional dynamics, things seem to be going their way. Assad seems more secure in Syria. The Saudis are still bogged down in Yemen. And, of course, we have the Saudis and the Emiratis creating a crisis involving Qatar, which right now is only helping Iran. So I think they're feeling reasonably secure about this, but they are complaining that the United States is doing things that in Iran's view, violate the deal.
Well, but there's something else about that, too, part and parcel to what we've been talking about this week. Also, the White House announced that it would be ending CIA shipments of arms to anti-Assad rebels in Syria, which also helps, frankly, Iran and the Russians. So for a president who, frankly, wants to put the screws to Iran, I'm not quite sure how that makes sense.
We'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder, you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Barbara Slavin of the Atlantic Council and All Monitor. Joining me on the show are Dan Raviv, senior Washington correspondent for I-24 News, and Paul Brandis, White House correspondent for West Wing Reports. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. The program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. Listen to it and tell us what you think by taking a short survey on our Facebook page. So let's continue with the Russia theme, since you raised it, Paul. It is very interesting that President Trump seems to be so hostile toward Iran and toward this nuclear agreement. Yet, when it comes to Syria, the policies taken by the Trump administration seem to jive very closely with those of Russia and Iran.
Yeah, well, the policy from the White House especially keeps changing. That's when you hear from Trump officials that he's only been in office for 6 months, so he's still, you know, reading up, meeting people. They're proud of the fact that on his three foreign trips, he got along with everyone so great. He obviously learned a lot. Okay, I got that. And maybe we'll be able to tell if he makes more public statements and more appearances at news conferences. Now, I think his conclusion for now about Syria is that America's enemy is ISIS or Daesh. And that's all that the U.S. really cares about. Whether President Bashar al-Assad stays in power or not, that's somebody else's problem. It's not what Washington cares about right now. He's not underlining human rights. And so the decision this past week, which reported and not yet fully confirmed, that the CIA will stop providing money and training to so-called moderate rebels inside Syria, it looks like a favor to Russia, but also President Trump would say, I'm not really that interested in the Syrian civil war. I just want to get Daesh or ISIS out of Raqqa, and then I can get the U.S. troops who are there, more than a few dozen special forces, I just want to get them out of Syria. I think that would be Trump's thinking.
Yet at the same time, though, if he says that Assad is not necessarily his concern, it's not his priority, and yet, of course, he launched those missiles at Syria a couple of months ago.
Well, because chemical weapons use is too terrible.
Well, but if he says this is, Syria and Assad is not our issue, what does he care? Why would he do that and then say, well, Assad and his behavior is not necessarily my concern? It's all about ISIS. Well, then why attack Assad?
You know, that was, I think, an easy, one-off. The real question always with that kind of thing is whether there's more of a policy behind. And we could spend a whole show talking about what will happen to Syria once ISIS is, quote-unquote, defeated.
That attack on the Syrian air base after the use of chemical weapons was not to show that the U.S. cares that much about the Syria issue, but that President Trump is no weakling. He's willing to take action. He's not like Obama, who had made threats regarding Syria and didn't do anything, as the Republicans put it. One other thing, that particular evening, he wanted to impress China's president, visiting Trump in Florida.
Yeah. I want to get back to the Russia issue, though, Dan. We have learned in the last few days that in addition to the official meeting that President Trump had with Russian President Vladimir Putin, in Hamburg, he had another meeting that was a little bit more informal. And explain why this is sort of raising eyebrows around
him. Well, the White House is saying just a conversation. So yes, the same date, July 7th, where we know about the official meeting. And some people said, wow, that was a small meeting. President Trump and his Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and a U.S. translator. Mm-hmm. On the Russian side, President Vladimir Putin, Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister, and a Russian translator. That's all. That was small. Think about the chat later. Very ironic. It was at a big dinner. The group of 20 is having a social dinner where leaders are put next to spouses, and so conversation was meant to be informal. Well, apparently President Trump, of course, noticed that across the table and to the left, his wife Melania is sitting with Vladimir Putin, and they're chatting through Putin's translator. Well, for one reason or another, and it does look to me, even from Trump's own account, in an interview this past week with the New York Times, that he might have been a little bored. He didn't feel he could communicate with the first ladies he was sitting next to from Argentina and Japan. And so he got up and ambled over to Putin, and that became a Putin-Trump conversation that, according to witnesses who told all about it, it looked kind of odd because it went on and on and on, ignoring everybody else, but still they all could see Trump and Putin sitting together. Yeah. Some people say it was nearly an hour. Trump says more like 15 minutes. But no one has any idea what was discussed, and there wasn't even a U.S. government translator. It's unusual, but I think it's Trump trying to establish a personal relationship.
Yeah. How unorthodox is this? I mean, there was some in the White House who said, oh, well, President Obama did it. Yeah. Well, he did, but he had his national security advisor, Susan Rice, sitting in on the meeting, as well as his own translator. Here it was Trump and Putin and Putin's translator.
Well, when prior presidents did this, these sidebar conversations at these events are perfectly normal. In prior administrations, these kind of things were always highly scripted. An interpreter was always at, whether it's Barack Obama, sure, George W. Bush, or what have you. So very unusual. But again, it's kind of how Trump operates, very unscripted and off the cuff.
Yeah, but Dan, let's put it in context. The president of the United States, or at least his close circle, is being investigated by a special counsel for ties between Russia and the campaign. So, the optics of it, are just quite amazing.
What Barbara, is that Donald Trump does not feel that pressure. He thinks the whole investigation is, as he's put it, a witch hunt, and yeah. there are no witches in existence, and so there's nothing there. And so he's going to plow ahead, and he's going to have his personal style. He doesn't need translators, and he doesn't need national security advisors in order to meet someone and have a chat and have a friendly and normal conversation, although later he admitted that it was also about Russian adoption, which is a code phrase for sanctions. Because Russia stopped adoptions by American couples as retaliation for President Obama's sanctions on Russia. And the president says it was about adoption. So there are many people, skeptics toward Trump, who say he's got something to hide. But again, the Trump White House says, just a conversation.
Yeah. I wanted to just one last bit on sort of where all of this stands. There's been a lot in the news with President Trump expressing unhappiness with his attorney general, who has recused himself from the Russian investigation because he met with Russian officials during the campaign. There was also some news about, more news yet, about a meeting that Donald Trump's son, Don Jr., had a year ago with a Russian lawyer. And it turns out there were other Russians in the room. The eighth man, Ike Kavaladze, a Russian-born U.S. citizen who is a vice president for a real estate group that's owned by a Trump friend. He apparently has had a rather checkered past involved with money laundering and whatnot. So there's plenty for the special counsel to look at, yeah?
Well, in the context of the president chatting again with Putin, all of this simply adds to suspicions that some people have, the president's opponents have. Look, that there's something fishy here. Why would he be doing this? I mean, the fact that he sat and had this lengthy, whether it's 15 minutes, whether it's an hour, we don't know, but a fairly lengthy chat, I think it's fair to say, with this seasoned leader of an adversary.
Who was a veteran of the KGB, we should point out.
It defies every rule of diplomacy and common sense for him to do that in this broader context of suspicions that people have of something going on between Donald Trump and the Russians. So it's not wise for him, I think, to do that. Of course, the White House has a very different view on that.
Yeah. One last, Dan, just any other comments on where this investigation stands and whether the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, is he secure in his position? In an interview with the New York Times that I think you referenced, Trump seemed to be very angry with him for recusing himself from involvement in the investigation.
Our listeners have to understand what that represents.
Sure.
Because Jeff Sessions was a United States senator, and during the campaign last year, he was perhaps the first Republican senator to come out in favor of Trump, and he certainly was active during the campaign. That shows loyalty toward Trump. As a result, his reward, he's the Attorney General of the United States. But he looked at the situation with the Russia issue and the campaign. He said, oh, I better recuse myself. So he did what almost everyone in town here in Washington thinks was an honorable thing, but the president's not impressed. Now, they say at the Department of Justice, that's Jeff Sessions' department, that there's a lot more for him to do. There is law enforcement in this country. There are murder rates that are high in cities like New Orleans and Chicago. The Justice Department has many things to do, civil rights, etc., with a Republican slant rather than the 8 years of Barack Obama's Democratic Party slant. And now, in addition, the investigations do continue. Robert Mueller is the special counsel, and Senate and House committees are investigating. That certainly continues.
Yeah. I wanted to end with a lighter note. There was a very interesting video that was posted on social media, Paul, of a young Saudi woman wearing what would be quite normal clothes in the West, but certainly not in Saudi Arabia, where women are clothed in black from head to toe, walking down a street in Riyadh wearing a miniskirt and a little crop top. She was detained, but let go. Is this some sign of new liberalism in Saudi Arabia? I thought it was kind of interesting.
Well, I don't know. We've seen these kind of glimmers of change in Saudi Arabia for quite some time, demographically. Big chunk of the population, I think, perhaps two-fifths of the population, under the age of 24. We hear about how much they enjoy Western culture, want perhaps more exposure to it. This is part of that. But women, in particular, Saudi Arabia is not just a repressive society in general, but in terms of women's rights, it's very much a masculine society. So, and I think this is just one chapter in maybe kind of a long changing trend.
There's always an issue here as to whether Saudi Arabia has the right to have its own culture and its own system, or whether the United States or Westerners or us on the Voice of America should tell them how to run things. It might be a glimmer of a little more freedom, but not a lot more, Barbara.
Yeah, well, I thought it was encouraging. Anyway, that's all the time we have. Paul Brandis, White House correspondent for West Wing Reports, and Dan Revive, senior Washington correspondent for I-24 News, joined us today. This program was produced by Rebecca Ward. Our engineer was Joe Gill. I'm Barbara Slavin. I'm director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Thanks for listening.